Welcome. Brilliant awareness, vast as infinite space, is our true nature. If we're looking for an identity, that's it. If we want to make something of ourselves, that's it. The something that is awareness only. And that awareness has never been confined in any way. Even though we may have taken ourselves to be someone who is confined within the skin line of a body, always and forever, our awareness is infinitely and forever blended and mingled as the vast expanse of infinite space, pure space that is entirely aware, naturally present, and completely responsive. To understand the reality of our own awareness, we must understand that awareness is entirely non-dual and beneficial in nature. If we just look at one aspect of awareness, its non-duality or its emanation of benefit, then we only see part of it. If we only look at an extreme of awareness, we only see one point of view within the vast expanse of awareness. So if we say awareness is this, it's nothingness, or no thought, or no self, or no concepts, or bliss, or clarity, or impartiality, or neutrality, or fatalism, or what, if we make it into something, then we just have another point of view about what awareness is. But when we relax deeply, just relax deeply as the experience, the direct experience of our own awareness that can never be interrupted by anything, we realize more and more that all of these points of view that occur within the pure view of awareness, they're just the dynamic energy of awareness and nothing else. Awareness isn't purer than the points of view, as they are inseparable. So you see, if we say one thing is purer than another, in other words, that points of view or phenomenon are impure and awareness is pure, then no longer do we have a non-dual, single, blissful expanse that is our true nature. We have two. We have the pure and the impure. The wholly positive basic space of awareness includes everything. So although it is beyond cause and effect, it includes cause and effect. Absolutely nothing is excluded. So when it comes down to the direct experience of this as our own awareness, it's very important to just rest naturally and realize that the essence of awareness is the only source, origin, or nature of every point of view. And what a point of view is just anything at all that can be thought, an emotion, a sensation, a circumstance, a person, a thing, all of these are points of view. But if we simplify everything that might be called illusion, maya, samsara, and we just call it points of view, that makes it a lot easier. Then we can see, oh yes, I am all-inclusive awakened awareness. The I take myself to be is synonymous, really, with the vast expanse of awareness. And within that awareness, included, contained, and subsumed are all points of view. They're the dynamic energy of awareness, inseparable from awareness, like the color blue is inseparable from the sky. And just as the color blue is inseparable from the sky, all the points of view, no matter what they are inseparable from awareness. They're the dynamic energy of awareness and nothing else. So all points of view of the magnificent display, the magical expression of brilliant awareness, are like a mirage. They're like a line drawn in water. A mirage, all of its elements, no matter what they are, no matter how much we tried to make something out of them, we never could. No matter how desperately we wanted a drink of water from a mirage of an oasis in the desert, and no matter how much we believed that water was there, we'd never get a drink of water in the mirage, because all of the elements of the mirage are aware basic space, and just like all points of view, all of the dynamic energy of awareness, all of it is aware basic space and nothing else. It has a vivid appearance, absolutely. We can't deny that. Look at all this. Look at all this. It's incredible. But to say that awareness is only empty, or that it only is aware basic space, is not to include all of its expressions or aspects. If we just say that awareness is aware basic space, that everything is empty, then we've adopted an extreme, and it's important not to do that. Because when we rest naturally as awareness and we realize that all of our own points of view that have seemed to be inward, as well as those that have seemed to be outward, that they're just all awareness and nothing else, and we relax deeply as that awareness, totally freely in the immediacy of every single point of view. As we relax, we feel an incredible warmth of bliss, love, wisdom, and compassion that naturally arises. So these things are the sign, evidence, and demonstration that we're waking up. You know, we're recognizing our birthright. We're recognizing the reality of what we are. And all of this from uncontrived rest. So this isn't wisdom and compassion that's developed or organized or learned or cultivated. It's that which is naturally occurring, always and forever naturally present, never needing to be attained or achieved. So it's very important to understand awareness and its three natural expressions. One of its natural expressions, and these three are inseparable. One of its natural expressions is basic space or emptiness. Awareness, vast as the infinite sky, is entirely empty. It's a basic space in which everything occurs. And it's not just empty, it's naturally present. None of us can deny that it's naturally present. So this is another of its expressions. Aware basic space that is naturally present. And that natural presence is responsive. So it's aware basic space that is naturally present as this vivid appearance and is entirely responsive. And what is the responsiveness of aware basic space? It's compassion and wisdom, love and warmth. And everything, absolutely everything, is included in that. So when we look into the true nature of any point of view, and that would be any word in the dictionary, basically, what we can see about that is, yes, it does have the vivid appearance of whatever its dictionary definition may be, but to that we can add the ultimate meaning of each of those words, and that is that each of those words, no matter what they are, it has no independent origin. It has no independent origin other than aware basic space that is naturally present and entirely responsive. This responsiveness that is compassionate, you may be thinking, well, if it's compassionate, why are there all of these horrible things going on in the world? The compassionate nature of self-knowing awareness, which is what each of us as a human being is that there is a choice for each human being to recognize awareness or not. That's the compassion of aware basic space. Each of us have a choice to live our life any way we want to. And if we decide to live our lives only focused on the dictionary definitions of the vivid appearance, then all of our life is based on point of view, and we experience ourselves as an ordinary body, speech, and mind that's all wrapped up in points of view, including the point of view of a personal identity. So you see, in aware basic space that is naturally present, there only is the dynamic energy of points of view, and all these points of view are equal in being mirage-like. All of the points of view are equal in being mirage-like, and they're all entirely even. So there aren't some good points of view and bad points of view and neutral points of view. They're all the dynamic energy of awareness, non-dual, beneficial in nature, all-inclusive, and nothing else. So this is also very important to know, because when it comes down to each of us, we have all kinds of points of view that are arising all the time within the basic space of our awareness. The point of view of a personal identity is just one of those. We rarely have this point of view. Rarely do we think, wow, I'm a personal identity. Look, I really am somebody. I'm so-and-so. I'm Candace. I'm Jerome, or I'm Kathy, or I am whoever I am. Very seldom do we have that point of view. Just as, you know, all the points of view, they're countless, ceaseless, and unpredictable. So you see, if our starting point in realizing who we are is that there's some kind of a fixed personal identity that's somehow part of awareness but separate from it, and that personal identity is a something called an ego or a psychology or an intellect or whatever it is, if we say there is this fixed personal identity that needs to be cured somehow or purified, then it's likely we'll spend all of our lives seeking. It's very likely we'll spend all of our lives seeking. When we rest naturally in a totally uncontrived way, in that rest that is the essence of every single perception, so all that means is any point of view arises, no matter what it is, there is uncontrived natural rest. This could also be called complete meditative stability as the essence of every perception. And when there is that complete uncontrived rest as the essence of every perception, then there is vivid wakefulness that outshines all points of view. Then suddenly, rather than awareness being over here and points of view being over here, they're entirely inseparable. In that vivid wakefulness that is the true reality of what we are, we suddenly see that the next point of view arises, abides, and vanishes naturally in, of, as, and through that awareness. And that no matter what the point of view is, and no matter what we've labeled it to be, exalted and sublime or mundane and pedestrian, that it's all awareness and nothing else. All awareness and nothing else. And based upon this realization, this evidence in ourselves, the direct experience of our own awareness, we feel this incredible warmth of love, bliss, and compassion that arises. This is naturally so. It's naturally occurring. It's naturally occurring in that as we rest, as the freedom of immediate perception, where we're entirely free as the vivid wakefulness that is the splendor of awareness in each perception, we give ourselves the benefit of feeling that warmth of compassion that is inseparable from awareness. And when we feel that compassion for ourselves, perhaps we have a negative point of view, something we've always thought we needed to change about ourselves. We all have these. In all of our lives, we've tried to change that thing. And we all have several of these, usually. We've done all kinds of things. We've read self-help books. We've done sadhana. We've done this, that, and the other thing. No matter what we do, that point of view, whatever it is, it still appears. We think we have it handled, we have the clamps on it, and all of a sudden there it is again. There's the point of view again. Well, point of view is totally unpredictable. The dynamic energy of awareness, it simply is. It's the magnificent display of awareness. So as the point of view arises that we've always been trying to do something about, we've been looking for antidotes for it, whatever they are. Maybe we've looked at work or money or food or sex or romance, relationships, whatever it is, extreme sports activities, risk-taking, crime, who knows, whatever it might be. We've been looking at some kind of antidote to somehow kind of resolve some kind of point of view we have, this kind of underlying anxiety that's with us all the time. And no matter what we try, it just won't go away. It just absolutely won't go away. Because what is occurring is we're applying one antidote to another. And then sometimes when it comes to spiritual practice, we've tried all those other points of view, they don't work. So we think, aha, I found it. Spiritual practice. That's going to fix my points of view. We'll get into some heavy-duty sadhana, and that's really going to fix my points of view. So then we try that. We try the sadhana. And we may feel much better, you know, much better. We develop discipline. We develop at least the discipline of being familiar with what's going on with ourselves. So this is very good. This is very good. But with any kind of efforting, the cure can become the disease. Do you understand what I'm saying? The cure can become the disease. So the cure can become another point of view. If we're engaged in all kinds of efforting, no matter what it is, and we're not resting naturally as the freedom that is the immediacy of every single perception while we're engaged in all our sadhana, it doesn't really matter what we're doing. Everything is sadhana, by the way. Every single perception is a sadhana. So unless we're resting naturally as that blazing splendor that is the awareness that is inseparable from every point of view, inseparable from every perception, then we can never really completely taste that freedom that we are. And once we taste that, that's wonderful. But then, you know, we also are that which we're gulping ourselves into ourselves. Do you see what I'm saying? There's nothing other than our true nature, our very own awareness. So there's really, the more that we realize this direct experience of awareness, the more we realize that there's no one experiencing that awareness. That this I that we've taken ourselves to be, it just gently loosens its grip. It loosens its grip. And we don't have to do anything about it. So we don't have to smash or annihilate an ego or an I or a personal identity or twist it into a certain shape or anything else. All we do is rest naturally in a totally uncontrived way. And as we do so, the tremendous force of what we are arises naturally, and everything comes into affinity and accord. So usually when we hear a direct message like this, it may turn everything we think upside down. That was the case for me anyway, 25 years ago, because I had been raised as a Roman Catholic, you see. So I had all kinds of ideas about what was good and what was bad and what was neutral. And then when I came face to face with myself with this conundrum of points of view swirling, whirling, just a tornado that couldn't be stopped, none of the practices that I developed did anything at all to stop that. Nothing, you know, because I had reached the ultimate sadhana. That's what had happened. Except I didn't know it was the ultimate sadhana at the time. And that was that I was face to face with myself. That's all. Face to face with my true self. And all of these things that I'd taken to be something other than myself, in other words, I was a subject and all these other things were objects that I was in relation to. I was an I, and then there were all these objects that I was in relation to. And they were my thoughts, feelings, actions, accumulated memories, everything I'd ever done, no matter what it was. The prayers I'd said every single day since I could talk. Everything I had ever done, all the philosophy books I had read, all the psychology books I had read, everything I knew about my own faith, Catholicism, everything I intuited about what was really, really real, none of these things would help me in this moment. not a single one of them. I was just bombarded with all the content of 34 years of thinking, feeling, and acting, and taking myself to be all that. And I didn't know what to do. I felt totally hopeless and powerless in the face of that. And no matter what I did, I couldn't figure out anything to do. No matter who I talked to, they didn't know what to do either. They'd say, "This too shall pass," or something like that. Well, it never did. You know, it just got worse and worse. Well, eventually they were right, but it wasn't fast enough for me. It really wasn't fast enough for me at all. And I was extremely intellectual, you know, extremely intellectual. I'd been labeled as bright all my life, and I'd been in a gifted program. So I really relied on my intellect a lot to get me through everything. Well, you know, that was of absolutely no solace whatsoever. The intellect was out the window. The intellect could solve no problems. Everything I knew about psychology, oh, this diagnosis or that diagnosis or what I might be going through when all this was coming up, none of that worked either. None of the psychologists, they knew not what to do. The priest didn't know what to do. The nuns didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do. No one knew what to do. I had just come face to face with myself. Well, you know, this is a rare opportunity for anyone. It's a totally rare opportunity, and it's the purpose of human life. We come face to face with ourselves. And this is what we are, awareness with all of its own dynamic energy. But all I could see was the dynamic energy. I was completely lost in the densest fog, a blinding snowstorm, and a huge avalanche of the dynamic energy of awareness. And I couldn't find my way out. Well, you know, if you're buried in an avalanche, do you know what to do? You definitely stop digging, but you spit and you see which way it falls, and then you know which way to dig. But first you see you have to rest. First of all, there's total panic. You know, there's complete panic. Oh, what do I do now? I'm in an avalanche. And then there's just the complete panic of that and all the thoughts that go with it. So resting naturally, it's very important when you're in an avalanche. And then in natural rest, see the solution that could never be thought of otherwise, it appears. Oh, of course, I'll spit and see which way it goes. So here I was, buried in the avalanche and unable to rest for a very long period of time. Completely unable to rest for a very, very long period of time. And finally, in my desperation and powerlessness, it just came to me that all of these points of view had an underlying basis. And that when I just relaxed, all that there was the underlying basis, the source, the origin, the unconditioned condition of all these points of view. And the more I relaxed, the more that was me, like within my skin line, and the more it was just the vast expanse of infinite space. I didn't even know what to call it. I just knew there was complete relief. So you see, this is what I suggest to you as an act of compassion for ourselves. And that's really what I want to talk about today, compassion, I think. Yeah. Compassion, that this is the ultimate act of compassion that we can give ourselves, to allow ourselves that complete freedom that is the freedom of the vivid wakefulness of the reality of what we are, that is the only source, origin, or condition of every single point of view, no matter what that point of view is. And when I was relaxing in this way, I wasn't looking for anything. I wasn't seeking anything other than that relief in each perception. And as I rested as one perception, I noticed that many of them just sort of slipped away. They just weren't there anymore. The avalanche started melting. And after 10 days, all of a sudden, I realized, wow, this is what I've always been. This is who I am. This is what I've always been. But, you know, and it didn't matter whether I was using the word I or not. It was just the naturally occurring, natural presence of something that couldn't be described. The only word that came out of my mouth initially was wow. And someone who comes here once in a while, he's labeled it wowness. Wowness. Wow. And then the other description that came to me was perfect love. I thought, oh, you know, this is what I've always been looking for. This is what I was looking for in every point of view. I was looking for its essence, really. I wasn't looking for the description to satisfy me. I was really looking for this essence all along. And so, you know, for each of us, when it comes to the reality of our own total freedom that is our birthright, we have the same choice. Freedom is immediate perception, and it is the ultimate act of compassion that we can give ourselves. And when we realize that all of our points of view, no matter how we've described them, positive, negative, or neutral, that they are all just a single blissful expanse of aware basic space and nothing else, then we live as the ground of compassion. We are the inherent compassion that doesn't need to be cultivated, developed, organized, studied, mandated in ourselves when we get up in the morning. I'm going to be compassionate today. It's the unrelenting, free-flowing compassion that's also naturally present, naturally occurring, always already the case. So this is very important, too, to know about ourselves. As we realize the immensity of compassion for ourselves, then we automatically realize it for everyone else. We automatically realize it for everyone else, because in realizing what we are, instantaneously we realize that everyone else is us. Awareness is inclusive of everything. And, you know, sometimes this happens in a blinding flash, but that is extremely rare. So if you're waiting for that, well, could be a long wait. But the time-honored tradition of what's called the yoga of natural rest in both Hinduism and Buddhism is this direct perception of awareness as our true nature, that is the natural rest, that is the throne, the easy chair of every single perception. The easy chair of every single perception. And when we realize each point of view as not only being its dictionary definition, but also this essence of awakened awareness, then we've reached the heart of the matter. Then we're really facing ourselves. And we not only have the warmth of compassion, but we have the immense power and force of the natural presence of awareness to carry out benefit for the whole. Just as we've benefited ourselves in resting naturally, we benefit the whole with the same immense power and force. All of our innate strengths, gifts, and talents come alive in an unimaginable way to be of great benefit. Compassion just felt as warmth, oh, I feel compassionate, that sort of thing, is incomplete without action. So compassion, just feeling compassion without action, that's incomplete. So you see, sometimes when we're trying to develop compassion as a point of view, we feel some compassion, but we don't feel the power to act. We don't know what to do. But when we rest naturally as awareness without seeking anything, rest naturally for short moments many times, it becomes automatic and permanent. And then the natural force and power of compassion arises, and we have that force and power that enables us to act. So this is very important. It's very important to know that who we are is not some extreme state that's cut out of life. That's an incomplete or extreme way of viewing enlightenment or awakening, or even being human, if you just want to call it that. Now I'd like to share with you a story about compassion. I may share several stories about compassion. First, I'd like to share a story about someone that I have a very close relationship with and someone who is very dear to me, and that is Wangdor Rinpoche, who is a Tibetan Buddhist monk and High Lama. And he was born in Tibet. He's an old man now, in his late 70s. And when he was in his late 20s, actually I think he was 30, it was 1959, and he was living with his guru there. They call their lamas gurus in the guru-disciple relationship. They called the lama a guru, and he was with his root guru, Tuksi Rinpoche, and there was the whole retinue there, all the students, and Tuksi Rinpoche's guru was there too. And they knew that they needed to leave Tibet. They knew they needed to leave Tibet, and they needed to go to India. And the old lama didn't want to go. He just didn't want to go. He didn't want to go at all. He was sitting there in a state of total, utter lucidity, the reality of everything that is, and he'd finished all his teaching, and he was just waiting to resolve into aware basic space. So he didn't want to go anywhere. But everybody else wanted to go. And some of them left. You know, they just left. They got scared and said, "We're leaving, you know. He doesn't want to go. Tuksi Rinpoche won't go. Wangdor won't go. Well, we're all going anyway." So they left and abandoned all of them there and in Tibet. And so finally the old lama, he said, "Okay, I will go." So then the next problem was that Tuksi Rinpoche couldn't walk. He couldn't walk very well. So he'd just walk a few steps and then he'd fall down. And so Wangdor Rinpoche, who was just an ordinary monk at the time, he really wanted Tuksi Rinpoche to go with him for a couple of reasons. One, Tuksi Rinpoche was the lineage holder for their lineage, so he had many secret teachings that Wangdor Rinpoche and the other monks wanted. And two, he knew that if Tuksi Rinpoche didn't get to India, all these teachings could die with Tuksi Rinpoche in Tibet. So many beings would never have the compassionate benefit of these wonderful teachings of the direct perception of awareness, or as in Tibetan Buddhism they call it, the direct perception of mind, Dharmakaya. And So they decided they'd hire some huge wild men to carry Tuksi Rinpoche to India. So they hired a couple of huge wild people, to enormous Tibetan mountain men, to carry Tuksi Rinpoche to India. And the men put Tuksi Rinpoche on their back and they started to walk up the hill, but he was so big they couldn't make it. They fell down. They try again and again and they kept falling down. So then they got a yak, an enormous yak. If you ever seen a yak, they're huge. They put Tuksi Rinpoche up on the yak and the yak started climbing up the mountain, but the yak collapsed. So they got another yak and they put Tuksi Rinpoche on the back of that yak. It started up the mountain, made it about halfway, and it too collapsed. And there was Tuksi Rinpoche halfway up the mountain. No one could get him up, no one could get him down. The wild people couldn't get him up and down, and the yaks couldn't get him up and down. So Wangdur Rinpoche, who was only 5'8", he decided he was going to carry Tuksi Rinpoche to India. That's what he decided. He said, I want my guru with me. It's more important than anything else. He has given me all of these teachings. He has given me my freedom. Without Tuksi Rinpoche, I would not be free. I would not even know what that is. And everyone else may abandon him, but I can't do that. No matter what it takes, I'm going to carry him to India, and I'm going to make sure that all the scriptures get there too. So he put Tuksi Rinpoche on his back and they started the journey to India. The two high lamas and their retinue, and on the way many people died. They'd go along narrow mountain trails. People would fall into the abyss. Wangdur Rinpoche would carry Tuksi Rinpoche on his back. They would cross a narrow log over an abyss. People would fall in. Wangdur Rinpoche would carry Tuksi Rinpoche on his back. All the way to India, he carried Tuksi Rinpoche on his back. So you see, when we think of our own compassion, it's really good to hear a story like this, because our own compassion is an immense force. We know that just as Wangdur is a human being, Wangdur Rinpoche like us, that we too are the embodiment of that kind of compassion. That kind of compassion that, through realizing compassion for himself and realizing his own ultimate freedom, he unleashed this immense power and force of compassion and benefit for all beings that enabled him to carry his guru safely all the way from Tibet to India. Isn't that amazing? So this kind of evidence of what we are is very important to hear about. When we take ourselves to be someone who is restricted or constrained or in some kind of a box about anything, you know, whether it's enlightenment or our gender or our nationality or our skin color or our caste or our socioeconomic status, or taking ourselves to be a personal identity or ego of any kind, we limit ourselves so severely. At no time in human history has it been more important for us as human beings to realize the force of this compassion that we are. And it's entirely up to each of us to do that, to just rest as awareness, to grow familiar with ourselves as the essence of awareness that is the heartbeat of every single point of view, the heartbeat of every perception, to really know ourselves as that, to give ourselves that immensity of compassion. And in that, we unleash this immense power and force that not only benefits us, but it's of great benefit to everyone. And we all can see very directly in our lives today that at no time has this been more important. So you see, if we have some kind of a direct teaching about who we are that focuses on awareness only without focusing also on the aspects of awareness that are inseparable from it, then that teaching is an extreme. You know, it's incomplete. We're human beings, obviously, right? That's the vivid appearance. That's the natural presence of awareness. But if we just see ourselves as human beings without seeing that our heart essence is awareness, then that's incomplete. That's totally incomplete. Then we only see ourselves as human beings caught within all kinds of points of view and taking ourselves to be this, that, and the other thing, this, that, and the other point of view. The reality of what we are is so much more immense than that. No matter who we are, and no matter what kind of forms we've taken on about who we are, it's important to just allow all those forms to rest too as points of view. To just know that anything we've taken ourselves to be, anything that we believe is necessary, is an objective support, some kind of thing to uphold who we take ourselves to be, some kind of thing we need to uphold our sense of personal comfort and well-being. Whatever that is, we just need to rest naturally as the direct perception of that and allow ourselves to just be the vast expanse of infinite space that's never been limited or restricted by anything. One thing we can say about all of us, if we want to put together some kind of form for enlightenment or category in which it's included, is to say that all human beings already are enlightened. That would be the starting point. As we already are awareness, everyone already is enlightened. And there's either recognition of that or non-recognition of it. It's as simple as that. And recognition of it is freedom, as each perception. Resting naturally as each perception, that's recognition of that. And with recognition as that, it becomes permanent. Repeated recognition of that, it becomes permanent. Once in a while, other practices may end up in some kind of enlightenment, but if the practice was what led to enlightenment, then everyone who did the practice would be enlightened. Do you understand what I'm saying? So perhaps the enlightenment is circumstantial, we don't know. But there is the time-honored tradition of what's called the yoga of natural rest, this direct perception of our own awareness, the direct perception of our own awareness that is unerring, that no one can give to us, no one can take away from us. No one has to confirm it for us because we know. We know whether we're at ease. We know whether we're at ease. We know whether this warmth of compassion is evident in us. We know. That about us that is always the case never has changed. It never has changed. And we have the direct evidence of it in our own experience. All of us have had the experience of looking in a mirror when we're a small child the first time, and then we look in the mirror at 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100, and whatever is looking, it's always the same. It never changes. It's like, wow, look at that. Look at all those wrinkles. Look at that gray hair. I'm getting old. Isn't that something? But, you know, there's something about me that's never changed. Well, you see, there's the vivid appearance as the natural presence of awareness. That's all, you know. So it's no big deal. That's what I'm saying. It's not some amazing thing. Some amazing thing is a state. Some kind of state that's usually an extreme. It's an amazing thing, but it isn't an amazing thing. Yeah? It's just the reality of what we are, the direct reality of what we are. We wouldn't be aware of being naturally present without awareness. Awareness is the constant in being naturally present. We wouldn't even know we're a human being without awareness as the constant. So see, evidence in every single moment. The evidence is right here. We don't have to look anywhere for it. It's just like being in quicksand. What do you do if you're in quicksand? You stop struggling. Or if you're in a muddy pond and you want it to settle, you don't jump around and stir it with a stick. You just rest and the pond settles in and of itself. Well, this is so with dynamic energy of awareness too. All these points of view, we don't have to do anything about them. They vanish naturally without a trace. They're their own undoing, like a knot in a snake. We don't have to do anything about a knot in a snake, it undoes itself. Or a contortionist, they get all contorted and then they undo themselves. So all points of view are just like this. Even if we try to do something about them, we never can. We just create another point of view. Pop, 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 like the popcorn in a hot pan. We create more and more and more and more points of view, trying to fix all the other points of view. But these points of view, they're countless, they're ceaseless, they're unpredictable. They keep firing off all over the place like firecrackers. And when we rest naturally, we see the magnificent display. We are the magnificent display, but we're not all involved in it. We're not all wrapped up in attachment to this one and aversion to that one. And we're the totality. Just the totality of the vast expanse. And all the points of view and their comings and goings, they're like the flight path of a bird in the sky. Nothing needs to be done. We can't say where the flight path of the bird came from or where it went or where the middle of it was or anything else. It just vanishes naturally in and of itself. So all our points of view, if anyone here has been trying to fix them and do something about them, just know they take care of themselves. Yeah, they really do. Uncontrived rest. How about resting without seeking anything as a sadhana? Rest without seeking anything. That's a great mantra. Rest without seeking anything. Rest is best. We only think we have to do something about the dynamic energy of awareness because we've adopted that mental concept from other people. Gotta fix those points of view. Gotta do something about my thoughts. Gotta do something about my emotional states. Gotta do something about my sensations, especially my sensations associated with desire. All the points of view, no matter what they are, they're equal. Has anyone ever tried to stop desire? Desire, it's the dynamic energy of awareness, self-knowing awareness, desiring itself. What would we do without desire? What would we do without desire? It's the great love affair, natural rest. Natural rest, to be totally at ease, as the essence of every single perception, as the heart essence of every single perception. Not some dry, abstracted state that denies any kind of connection with life. Just the reality of our blazing brightness. The vivid wakefulness that is the great reality of what we are.
So, how can you say, in a sense of saying good, discipline is good? I heard that saying. I find out that discipline that is coming from doing, from yoga, from acting, from mantra, whatever, is sterilizing the human being, this spontaneity, and it just makes you dull. And deaf or whatever, and pretended to be sane, but you actually are not. So I heard you a few times saying to people who did a lot of discipline, exterior discipline, I'm talking, not talking about the discipline that lies from the inside through understanding of awareness, you kept saying this is good. So now you say such a beautiful thing about aliveness of desire, and sometimes I heard you say, well, this out of compassion, you say, good boy. Or what is there any good in this activity?
In sadhana? Oh, I say everything's included. If you want to do sadhana for the rest of your life, do it. Just rest naturally while you're doing it, you know. The sadhana. Really, it does. If sadhana, what a beautiful expression of living. Sadhana, what a beautiful expression of living. What a beautiful celebration of living. There are many other beautiful celebrations of living too. Being a parent, loving the community we live in, making sure that our streets are clean and our air is clean. Ah, there's a celebration of life. So all of these, all points of view are sadhana, no matter what they are. If they're shaped, but you know, the spiritual and the non-spiritual are equal, and this is what it comes down to for all of us, that everything we've ever learned, taken ourselves to be, felt ourselves subject to, that we've never been subject to anything. So, you know, in this room, there are people from the East and West. Some of us have thought ourselves subject to original sin. So some of us have thought ourselves subject to karma and reincarnation. And maybe we were born in the West and we were born hearing of this concept of original sin, whether we were Christian or not. It pervades into all of Western culture. So sometimes then we replace original sin with karma and reincarnation as another way to take ourselves to be. Well, no matter what these points of view are that we've taken ourselves to be, at some point we have to realize that they're all equal. They're all entirely equal. They're an equal expanse of holy, positive, original purity. So if we're subject to anything, it's original purity. That's what we're subject to, original purity. But you know, so this is the sadhana. There's a tongue twister. It is. It's just, you know, we're always entirely free in our own place. Whatever our points of view are, any person sitting in this room, each one of us has countless points of view. And they're all aware basic space, no matter what they are. So each of us, we're the celebration of ourselves. All of our points of view, no matter what they may be, they're the celebration of ourselves. Every human being who has ever realized who they are have been faced with this intensity of the direct encounter with all their points of view. Yesterday I was telling the story in a simple human way about the Buddha's enlightenment. The Buddha went through the same thing, you know, looking at all these points of view one after another, and lust and anger and neglect, irresponsibility for his family, all these things that were going on within him, abandoning his three gurus, you know. Everything. All of these things he confronted. And so whatever our points of view are, that's our celebration of our awareness. That's the total celebration of our awareness. So sometimes when we've got to get enlightened, we think, oh, you know, I've got to get enlightened, and I've done all these other things in my life, and everything I've done has involved hard work. You know, I've had to grow up and be an adult. That's hard work, especially adolescence. That's really hard work. And then I've got to get a job. Wow. And maybe when you were a child, you had to work too. So, you know, you've been working all your life. And so, you know, life is hard work. You've got to work for everything you get. That's what most of us learn. So then when it comes to something as exalted as enlightenment, the conventional assumption is, I really have to work to get enlightened. I really have to work to get that. So then when we hear that resting naturally, and this is what it comes down to for everyone, resting naturally as the heart essence of every single perception is the secret key to enlightenment, we think, wow, that can't be. That's way too easy. It's cheating. It's cheating. Well, but you see, again, all of these sadhanas are, they just are whatever they are for each of us. One of us may be dressed in orange robes and be a sannyasin. One of us may be doing all kinds of yogic practices and be dressed as in Western garb. One of us may be a housewife from Georgia. And there was a great guru who was a housewife from Georgia, Jean Dunn, one of Nisargadatta Maharaj's disciples. So, you know, we never know. We never know what awareness looks like all of this. Awareness looks like all of us. And whatever our points of view are, that's our sadhana. And if we spend our entire lifetime trying to divvy our points of view up into three containers, good, bad, and neutral, and then exchanging them, got to put more good ones in the bad, and bad ones, we've got to throw outside all three containers. We've got to get rid of those bad ones. We'll keep taking them out, But every time we look in, there are more of them in there. It's supposed to be getting empty, but there's just more and more stuff in there. Well, what are we going to do about that? There's nothing that can be done. That's what I'm saying here. There's nothing that can be done. There's nothing to do, and there's no one to do it. So all we can do is rest and realize that the essence of every single one of these perceptions, these points of view that we've been trying to fix, they're the celebration of what we are and nothing else. They're the celebration of whatever we want to call it. In the Great Freedom Teaching, we use the word awareness because that is a word any human being can understand. But this word awareness, it's synonymous with God, Goddess, Divine Mother, Great Spirit, the Absolute, Brahman, whatever you want to call it. It's fine. And there are many other names too. I don't want to exclude any. But it's especially synonymous with everyone in this room and all 7 billion people on Earth. So, you know, whatever we take ourselves to be is what we are. That's what it comes down to. Whatever I take you to be, you are. Whatever you take me to be, I am to you. Do you see what I'm saying? And when we realize that the essence of what we are, everything that we are, not just some of the things that we are, not some kind of philosophical construct of what we are, but everything that we are, it is God. It is the Absolute. It is the Divine Mother, or whatever you want to call it, the heart. Some people like to call it the heart. That's good too. You don't have to use my term. But it all comes down to awareness. When we experience God, awareness as God, awareness is the constant. When we experience the heart, awareness is the heart. We experience the Divine Mother, awareness as the Divine Mother. It's all equal. We experience the guru, awareness is the guru. We experience ourselves, awareness is ourselves. Yes.
You touched on the topic of desire and how it was awareness desiring itself, mm-hmm. and it seems to be a good thing. How does resting in the point of view apply? Well, suppose you have something like you desire to eat, but you keep on eating and eating and eating. Or you desire very strongly a cigarette and you have to keep smoking. If you then rest in the perception, what happens to those desires, those compulsive desires?
Are these hypothetical questions, or do they apply to you? Ask me something that applies to you. Covers pulled.
Well, occasionally I have sexual thoughts.
Hooray! You're a fine yogi, Glenn.
Uh-huh. And I feel sometimes the compulsion to indulge. Quite often, well, if I talk in terms of emissions, then that might be the easiest way. The day after an emission, I will feel quite often quite depressed. Like I've drained something out of my body. When I close my eyes, I feel a kind of magnetic energy. Like it's almost like, this is, I'm talking about the day after here. I close my eyes and I feel kind of a healing energy coming in to replenish what I've wasted, perhaps. But it doesn't feel like a very pleasant energy. And I have to sort of live with that for the whole day. I mean, it doesn't happen very often, over the years and with the yoga practice, these sorts of things have gone away, kind of thing. But they seem to attack me out of the blue occasionally. And I'm just wondering if you could say a little more about how to rest within the perception when that arises, that desire arises. Mm-hmm. And what the result of that might be.
First of all, thank you very much for your candor. It's really beautiful. It's very, very beautiful. Not only for you, but for everyone here.
I don't see myself as being any different from anyone else. Mm-hmm. I know we all have the same kind of makeup in many respects. And I'm sure many men identify with what I've said. So I don't know about women.
The women do too. Are there any women here who have no sexual impulses? We do too. But when desire arises, sexual desire, rest naturally when that desire arises. Rest naturally. Get to know that desire as awareness rather than as being something that has a further elaboration or description. Because you see, what's happening now is that the desire arises and then there are elaborations that go on for at least a couple of days, it sounds, plus the memories of it, and then when it comes up the next time, the fear of it. So it's very important for you to get to know it as it is. Don't elaborate. But that, I didn't say don't go with it. I said rest naturally as the perception and you'll know exactly what to do.
What means elaborate?
Elaborate means to make a story out of it. So the perception comes up of desire and I'll speak for myself rather than you. When I'm saying this, say the perception of desire comes up. There's natural rest as that desire. And then in that natural rest, everything is known about the desire, not just desire as either something to be indulged or renounced. Do you understand what I'm saying? The essence of awareness is directly experienced as the only origin of the desire. So with our points of view that we consider to be challenging, it's very important to understand their true makeup. Nothing whatsoever is excluded from awareness, and definitely sexual experience is not excluded. The ideas that you have associated with sexual experience is draining you, or affecting your chakras, or all of these are further elaboration. They're just more points of view. And also, I would say, from what I know anyway about the great traditions of the world, that these points of view are all points of view you've learned from someone else. So they're not even your own points of view. There may be things you've read in books or things that you've had suggested to you, and then you've interpreted your own experience through these points of view. So all, but you see, mostly it's important to just rest naturally as the essence of awareness. Understand what desire is thoroughly. Understand that awareness is inclusive of all points of view, including the point of view of desire, feeling desire, and also loving, sexual loving, whether it's sexual loving of yourself or sexual loving with someone else. Every single thing is included, but you see, this is true yoga. This is when the rubber hits the road. When you realize that everything that you've been trying not to do, that you're doing it, you know? Because you see, in every sadhana, the closer you get to realizing who you are, the more you're gonna have all these points of view you don't wanna have. This is, see, I told you the story about the Buddha yesterday, and I referred to it today too. He's sitting there, you know, he has everything going on. He has thousands of dancing maidens going through his imagination, and he knows he could have them all sexually because he's a prince, so he can have anything he wants, you know. So it's all up for him, so to speak. You know, it's just, it's all up for him. And what did he do? He just sat there and he rested naturally. He came to know the essence of all perceptions. So see, you know, we can talk about anything here, and I'm glad you brought this up, because I know that this will serve many other people too. This is an area that very often is cut out of spiritual life. When it comes to enlightenment, it seems we've got to do something about sex, something that good, something that feels that good and is that messy, can't fit. That it can't fit in spiritual life, right? Huh? Yeah. So, you see, we really get to know everything there is to know about sex when we rest naturally. And I can tell you this, that there's no sex like resting naturally sex. If you've been having a good time from point of view, just wait. I've read many of these different ways of looking at sex, and well, what I recommend is just check it out for yourself. Rest naturally, get to know yourself as a sexual being who is entirely aware, and just enjoy the adventure of that, the exploration of that. Just enjoy it. Without seeing it one way or another. There's nothing to be afraid of. And sometimes getting to know ourselves as sexual beings, some of us enjoy self-loving, you know, what is sometimes called masturbation. And many of us learn that that's wrong. There's something terrible about that. Masturbation, it's no-no, you know, warts on the hand, all these other things, right? We all learn these things, I know we do. And so when it comes to holiness, sacredness, and we've been told all of our lives that this isn't holy and it isn't sacred, then sometimes we might line ourselves up with a spiritual practice that says the same thing. But you see, everything is included, and in terms of awakened awareness that's fully evident, we'll have to face it all. We'll have to face it all, and it's okay. There's support for that. The Great Freedom Teaching, it's no longer one of those things where you come to India, you go home, and suddenly there's no one to talk to, especially if you live in the West. We have a 24/7 hotline. Call it from anywhere in the world, you'll get a call back. Or someone will pick up the phone. And we answer all our emails within 24 hours. There's great support for natural rest. Just naturally resting is the reality of what we are. The great celebration of what we are. This is true compassion that includes everything, where nothing's excised from life. Oh, I'm going to be spiritual, so I guess I'm going to have to do some surgical excisions on my points of view. But even if we spend many years doing surgical excisions and finally we reach the domain of enlightenment, we're getting close. We can feel it coming. We're going to have to face all these things. So everything's included. That means at some point we're going to have to face all those things that we thought were excluded. But it need not be a fearful proposition, and it need not be faced alone. So all of these things, they need to be talked about more openly, because it normalizes everything, you see. Then it normalizes us as just what we are. And that is immensely compassionate. So self-loving is okay, loving others is okay. Making choices about how to love others is okay. You know, whether it's one or two or however we want to love. We know all this through resting naturally. Are there any other questions? Something more about that, Glenn? We'll sit quietly for a moment before we close.